Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is backgammon expert Bob Wachtel, discussing his book, In the Game Until the End, Winning in Ace Point Endgames. In the 7 years we've been doing this podcast, Bob Wachtel is the first guest that has been known by both of our co-hosts for more than 30 years. Bob Wachtel, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, gentlemen.
So, when did you start gambling, and approximately when did you develop into being an expert player at backgammon?
I was quite a good young chess player as a kid. I grew up in New Jersey, and I won the New Jersey Junior Championship a few times and placed high in the U.S. Junior Championships. I was second a few times. But I found that even though I would have liked to gamble at chess, it wasn't really very easy. I did once have a session with some guy who thought he was pretty good, but I beat him 12 out of 14 games. And there's just no hustle in chess, unless you hustle, which I don't do. So when you play somebody and they're better than you, you realize pretty quickly that you're not going to win. After high school, excuse me, I would have liked to have gone on to become a chess professional. Although looking back on it, I would have been not a very good one. I might have made it to Grandmaster, but I would have been a pretty weak one. So my parents convinced me to get a higher education. And I eventually hid away in graduate school until the age of about 27, I got a PhD in the philosophy of science. And it was impossible at that time to get a job. There were a lot of people who'd been dodging the Vietnam War by going to graduate school. And there was just a surfeit of very competent professors. So I couldn't really get a job as a professor. And to tell you the truth, I probably didn't want to. And I started, my graduate studies were in Toronto at the University of Toronto. And I played on the chess team there. And once I got the degree, I started going back to the chess club. And this was 1976, 77, when backgammon was a fad in the United States and Canada. I was in Canada, but and everybody at the chess club was playing this new game, and I started playing, and I was pretty good right away, and I was able to win money from my chess friends. And after I'd played for a couple of years, a friend of mine had gone to Vancouver, and he called me up and he said, there are these great games on the beach in Vancouver. You've got to come. You've got to get on a plane and get here. These players are terrible and we're going to make lots of money. So I did that. I jumped on a plane and we ended up playing a couple of guys on the beach in Vancouver, and they didn't pay us. That was pretty standard for that kind of era, except one of the guys had a little bit of pity on us, and he, in lieu of about $4,000 that we were up, he gave us a used Volkswagen, and I didn't know how to drive a stick shift, so that was a bit of a problem. And the guy took us out, tried to explain. He was like a Middle Eastern character, and his English wasn't that good, and he just sort of gave us the instruction that you just have to shift when it feels right. But with that car, I eventually found my way to San Francisco, and where there were some chess friends who had poker games and backgammon games, and then to Los Angeles, to the Cavendish West, where I found a club where I could play for a few years, and that was the beginning of my backgammon career.
Well, I met you at the Cavendish West. I started there in about 75, so it might have been a few years before you. The listeners of this podcast are used to me being a gambling professional, kind of a elder statesman in the gambling world. At the Cavendish West, I was in my mid-20s and just starting out. I never became better than a strong intermediate. I played there more than 10 years, off and on. possibly, I was close to Bob Wachtel's level when I first met him, but that didn't last long. He kept improving at a faster rate than I did. So he has no recollection of me being a gambling expert. All of his recollection would be me as a gambling intermediate. But it was a friendly enough relationship. And tell us your experience with the Cavendish West, Bob. What was it like, and how did that go?
Well, the Cavendish West was a curious place. It was basically a bridge club that had morphed into a bridge slash backgammon club.
Slash gin rummy.
Yeah, there was gin rummy as well. And there were a couple of...
Persian games.
Yeah, but that's not what I was going to say. Thanks, though. There were a couple of Hollywood celebrities there.
Yes.
One of my favorites was Don Adams.
Line two. Double fours.
And I was sitting around with Don one day, and he looked really glum. And I said, "Well, what's wrong, Don?" He said, "Well, I'm paying alimony to five wives." I said, "Well, Don, didn't you learn? You know, couldn't you get the idea that that might not be a great thing to do?" He said, "Bob," in this sort of,
Maxwell Smart in the Smart era.
The way he could talk out of the side of his mouth, he said, "Bob, the first year is worth it." Now, anyway, so the Cavendish consisted of some interesting sociological types. There were a few hustlers. You might call them professionals, but they were really bad players in truth, or quite just basically intermediate players, let's say. But they had an entourage of customers that they were able to keep corralled, because the type of backgammon that was played mostly in the club was called chouette. And chouette is a kind of like a king of the hill kind of structure, where one player is pitted against all the others in the group. And the others gang up on him, him or her. And then when the king of the hill, who's called the box, loses, he's dethroned, and the person who beat him becomes the box. So at no time are you playing one-on-one. You're always playing one against four or one against five. And when you're in the box, you're under quite a lot of pressure. But when you're not in the box, you have the comfort of being part of a team. And this sort of dilutes the advantage that a good player has, because it's the good player is usually not in the box. So at any rate, what these hustlers would do is they'd convince their customers, who are all really bad players, that they were protecting them from sharks like me. Uh-huh. And, when I would come near one of those games, the hustler would immediately say, "Why don't you go and play with the big boys? You're too good for us." And all of his pigeons, the people who he was winning money from, would thank him for protecting them. So I ended up being barred from a lot of games. In fact, the very first time I came to the Cavendish, they had a rule that you would only watch at the behest of the players. You could only watch a game at the behest of the players, and if they asked you to leave because your watching bothered them, you had to. So the first afternoon that I went to the Cavendish, there was only one game going. They wouldn't let me in. And when I tried to watch, one of the players, who was sort of a hustler of his own — there might have been two hustlers in this game — asked me to leave, and there was nowhere for me to go. But there were some people who flaked off from those groups, or other semi-pros who weren't welcome in those hustlers' chouettes. But I was usually better than they were, and I was able to play them either heads up or play propositions with them. And once in a while, we could start a chouette of our own, where there were a couple of more decent players than in the hustler's chouette, but still there were lots of other players who might have been too strong for the hustler's chouette, but they were weak enough for us to beat pretty easily. So that was the sort of social structure. There were lots. It was sort of a maybe 50% Persian club. Backgammon's a tremendously popular game in the Middle East, and Los Angeles has a big population of Persians, and this club was all Persian Jews, actually. But they have their own culture, where there's a lot of insulting that goes on, and a lot of yelling, and a lot of quarreling, which wasn't really too easy for me to deal with, but it prevented them from ever really paying attention to what they were doing. And the other very advantageous aspect of the Cavendish Club was that the chouettes were non-consulting. And what that means is that when you were in the box in a chouette and you're playing all the other players, let's say you're playing for $10 a point, which was a common stake at that time. If you're playing four other players, you're playing for $40 a point. But those other players don't really have much of an advantage, or they're actually at a disadvantage if they can't help one another. And the rules at the Cavendish, which varied greatly from the rules on the East Coast, were that you couldn't talk at all. It's called non-consulting. They couldn't help one another. So if I was playing...
But they did.
What's that?
But they did. There's all kinds of subtle ways that they did help.
Well, but that's something that I would absolutely welcome. You know, they can try to help each other as much as they want. But, and once in a while, somebody would do something like that. If the player was making an obvious mistake, there was one guy who used to say, "What's the roll? It's a 5-4. Oh," so that the player would look two or three times and finally realized the blunder he was making. But the big picture was that the players never improved because they couldn't learn from one another. And the Chouette structure is a wonderful one for learning backgammon, because if you're on a team and you have the mutual goal of making the best play, the better players will do their best not only to suggest the right move, but also to explain why it's the right move. And in that way, you can actually learn how to play. So Cavendish didn't have that feature, and the players never improved. So it was, and they played at a low level and stayed that way.
So Richard, I met you at the Cavendish as well. What are your recollections of the place?
Well, the Cavendish in Los Angeles was very, very different. I grew up in the Cavendish in Chicago. There were two Cavendishes, and the one that I was at daily was called the Cavendish North. Our rules couldn't have been more different than Los Angeles. In Chicago, their rule was all Chouettes were open. So if it was three or more players and somebody wanted to get in, they had to be allowed in. And they were consulting. So there was discussion about all of the moves. And as Bob says, it allows you to learn much quicker when the better players are explaining why they want to make a particular move. But when I got to Los Angeles, I found it very difficult just because, as Bob pointed out, it was hard to get into the good Chouettes. So I did not spend a lot of time at the Cavendish there just for that reason. Also, by the time I got to Los Angeles, backgammon was starting to wind down and was nowhere near as lucrative as it had been in years past.
One of the big... Some of the things Bob Wachtel was talking about you couldn't watch was because some of the pros were cheating. George Sagarin is one, although he's dead, so he can't get back at me. So he would get his customers, he would pay for their meals. They had a kitchen there, and he would buy their meals. And, you know, a $15 meal, when you're playing $10 a point, or sometimes it was $5 a point, you have to have a pretty big edge in order to subsidize that. And he would sometimes even pay their hourly fee. The way the Cavendish supported itself was every so many hours they collected a fee for the use of the facilities. And the size of the fee was based on the stakes of the game. So a $5 Chouette would not pay as much as a $10 Chouette. And then clever players got around that for a while by making it a $5 Chouette, but starting the cube at 2, which turned it into a $10 Chouette, but they were paying the rate for a $5 Chouette, and that didn't last real long. But gamblers are always looking for an edge. I was certainly welcome to play in the Sagarin Chouette for a few months. After a while, I was too strong. I had the nerve of making some plays that meant I was studying somewhere. And when Paul McGreal's book came out, there was a seismic shift in the level of the play on all the Chouettes, which filtered down even to the pigeon level Chouettes. Paul McGreal's book, which we're going to talk about later, explained things like slotting and running games, back games, and put a vocabulary to a lot of the things that we didn't know, and numbers of when you should double and when you shouldn't. The books before McGreal by Jacoby and Crawford, and there were a lot of them, weren't that good. But McGreal's book was a seismic shift. So all the players of the Cavendish eventually got better when McGreal's book came out. So, Bob Wachtel, there was a Mayfair Club in New York City. How is that similar to the Cavendish West, the Cavendish North, and how is it different?
It was very different. I visited the Mayfair in 1982, I believe, 81 or 82. I was really like looking for competition. I felt like I was the best player in LA at the time. May or may not have been, but I decided I'd go to New York and see what they had to offer. And I knew that all the best players, the legendary players, were Mayfair habitués, or whatever the word is. They hung out there, and I found it was really different. The Chouettes were sometimes 10, 12, 15 handed. The box could take a partner, but there was a tremendous level of competition, of discussion and argument, and a lot of New York sarcasm injected into almost every chouette and every game. There were challenges made all the time, and you had to have a really thick skin to deal with it, and you had to be really good. And what I ended up doing is playing all the house pros one after the other. They would play me in 4-hour shifts, and I put in like 10 hours a day of playing backgammon against the best players in the world. Because the Mayfair was actually, you'd have to compare it to a continuous graduate level course in backgammon. It was all the best players who existed on the planet at the time, and they were all bitterly competing with each other, playing propositions with each other, and they were all really sharp. So I eventually got ground down and lost most of my ill-gotten Los Angeles money.
Some of it used to be mine.
Right. But it was a place where a lot of like Eric Seidel, the great poker player, was a backgammon player in the beginning, and I used to play him all the time. And I could tell right away that he was that he had something extra, because we'd be playing a game and he'd go, "Walk." That was my nickname. He goes, "Don't let anybody know I'm doing this, but you know, I'm going to double this game. Just leave it between us." So he was always playing psychological games like that, even at backgammon, where it's very different from poker because all the information is available to both players. But he still, you could tell that he understood the psychology really well, and he'd get me confused at times, even though I could look at the position. I'd not really know how to evaluate his commentary. But that was the place where Paul McGreal, Jason Lester, Billy Horan, Roger Lowe, Eric Seidel, and a few other...
Senkiewicz was there at the time?
Who?
Mike Senkiewicz.
Mike Senkiewicz, yep.
Was Kit Woolsey there at the time?
No, Kit's from the... not
San Francisco.
Yeah. No, okay. I think he was originally from Boston, I think. But...
Waterman was there for a while. I don't know if his...
No, he's not from New York.
He's not from there, but he played there for quite a bit.
Yeah, I guess so. And Stan Thompson, who was
yes,
one of the early... I'll tell you a little Stan Thompson story when we get to talking about McGreal. But that was the Mayfair. It was very different. And what I found fascinating is that there was a Mayfair attitude, which was like, we're the pros, and we're not going to be polite to the fish. We're going to insult them. We're going to tell them they're idiots. We don't need money that badly that we're going to kiss their ass in any way. So if you were a weaker player, in that environment, you took a lot of abuse. And of course, a lot of the fish left. But at that time, in the beginning of the backgammon boom, or maybe the middle of it, there were still so many fish available that even if you drove away half of them, there was still lots of money to be made. So but what would happen is that when a chouette started, these abusive, supercilious pros would have to become diplomats all of a sudden when they were trying to help the player who was representing their money. So let's say I was one of these New York pros. I'm basically an ass to everyone, except that now one of the fish is playing for me on the team, and he's about to, you know, blow up our position and make and flush all my money down the toilet. Now I've got to communicate with him in a completely different way. So all of a sudden, these pros would say something like, "Well, Jim, that's a great idea, but could we take another look at it? Maybe let's count the race." And they'd calm down the player who was representing them and soothe them and gently persuade them to make the right move. Because the funny thing about the chouette structure is that when you're either in the box or you're the captain of the team, and that's what it's called, being captain, you sort of have a lot of power. And it's intoxicating. It's frightening, but intoxicating. And it was sort of normal for the team captain, no matter how weak they were, to insist, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, to insist on the moves that that they liked, regardless of whether they were right or not, or regardless of what the other players thought. So the pros would have to gently talk them down to the point where they could hear what the pro was saying and eventually get them to make the right move.
Bob, so many of the really good backgammon players and chess players, for that matter, moved into poker. I think mainly because there was so much more money in poker than there is in backgammon or chess. Did that ever appeal to you? Did you move into poker at all, or no?
Well, no. Actually, I don't really like poker that much, and I'm not that good at it. And having talked to a lot of these guys who did that, I'm not sure about Eric, but I talked to Jason Lester recently, and you know, a lot of them don't like poker as much as backgammon, but they followed the money.
Sure.
And I don't think that the skills carry over as much as you'd think they do. Of course, if you're a game player, you're a good game player, you can be good at any game because you have good powers of concentration and you care about doing the right thing. You have sort of an inborn respect for the truth.
But and if you're a good game player, you're probably pretty bright.
Yeah.
And that's important in all games, many games anyway.
But for me, poker has really different skill set. And it's not a skill set that I really have a natural inclination to. Because in poker, one of the most important things you have to do is pay attention to your opponents. And you have to get inside their heads, think what they're thinking. To me, one of the great luxuries of backgammon was that, or chess, is that I didn't have to do that. I could just play the board, and whatever insipid sort of stuff this other guy I was playing was thinking about, I didn't have to know what he was thinking about. He'd finally make a move and that would be it. But in poker, you really have to pay attention to other people and really care about what they're thinking and whether they're steaming or upset or like trying to get even or playing defensively or, and I'm just not suited to it. I also sort of feel like in poker, there's the whole thing of do you give off a tell? And I my feeling when I play poker is that I'm more readable than I'm reading. So I don't really feel like I've got a good enough edge.
Back at the Mayfair, one of the brightest stars was Paul McGreal. How well did you know him?
I knew him as well as other people. I wasn't really that that intimate with him, but I understood him. He was a professor.
Yes.
And he'd found in backgammon a new sort of area, untrammeled and unresearched, where he could do research. He was really like a research scientist, which my dad was, by the way. But he, more than anyone, he enjoyed figuring out backgammon on a deep level. And although there were some amazing players who played there, and McGreal was only their equal, and actually in money games he was a huge underdog because he was a terrible gambler, but he was able to organize a lot of the knowledge that these Mayfair geniuses had gleaned after from years of work and cutthroat competition. And when his book was published, it did come as a revelation, not to those players. Those players knew all this stuff and thought that McGreal was sort of just pandering to the, you know, the general public and sort of giving away trade secrets. But he was able to organize the material in a way that beginners, intermediates, and students of the game could absorb really easily. So that was his contribution, really, to backgammon. And he was also like a good booster for the game. And when he was young, he had a New York Times column, and he did a lot of sort of some enthusiastic promotion of the game. So he had this personality that people loved, because he was one of these characters who's always upbeat and always sort of like a puppy. Like, you know how a puppy, if you give it a ball, it'll just run after the ball forever. Well, McGreal was sort of like that in backgammon. He was always enthralled by a backgammon position, and he'd look at it, and he actually had a mannerism where his tongue would sort of stick out to the side of his mouth, which reminds you of sort of a little puppy who's panting a bit. And he brought a lot of enthusiasm to the game. And for that reason, he was beloved for years and years and years after those early days. He had a lot of issues in his life, a lot of drug use, and he was a bad gambler, and a lot of other things that prevented him from replicating his early successes. But he was still like, you know, a fixture in the backgammon community. And if you could ever see McGreal, go out with McGreal, play a match with McGreal, it was a big deal, especially to the, you know, to the ordinary player.
It's definitely true. A lot of the things Bob just shared with us, he you can find on YouTube. Paul McGreal died in 2018. Wachtel wrote and narrated a video that served both as a requiem for Paul McGreal and a brief history of modern backgammon. So it is on YouTube. It's about 17 minutes. The citation for it will be in the show notes. So however you get this podcast, if you go to gamblingwithanedge.com, in the show notes will be a link to the Wachtel Requiem to Paul McGreal. I recommend that you take a peek at it. So we're three-fourths of the way through, and we haven't even talked about the book that is the reason for you being on the air.
That's the reason? Oh, no.
I thought we should tell you sometime. So what is the Ace Point game, and how did this come about?
Well, we're talking about a book that's 25 years old. I wrote it in 1992 after being a pro for a number of years. I went to I had a little hiatus in my gambling career, not really in my gambling career, but in my backgammon career. I was an options trader for 5 years in Philadelphia. And actually, it was an ex-backgammon player, a guy named Chris Peterson, who had found that opportunity, and I worked for him. But anyway, I made and lost a few fortunes there as an options trader, and I moved to England in 1991 to try to pursue that career on the options markets there. It didn't work out. And I ended up going to the backgammon club. It was called the Double Fives in London. But I was barred from the club quite quickly by the house pro. So I decided, damn it, you know, what am I going to do here in London? And I decided to write this book. It was the first chance I'd had, sort of, where I hadn't been in action for a while. So the book is a strange type of backgammon book, because almost every backgammon book is sort of a general kind of how to win at backgammon kind of thing, or 100 backgammon problems, that kind of thing. But I was a chess player, as I said originally, and the chess literature is far more developed than the literature in backgammon and even in poker now. And it had gotten to the point where very specific areas of the game, people would write monographs about very specific opening variations or even end game variations. For example, in chess, you can have a king and a pawn against a king. I mean, that's basically, you can't get any less material on the board than that. But there are books written about just those positions, like it matters where the pawn is, where the kings are. Then there are even bigger books about a rook and a pawn against a rook, a rook, king, rook, and pawn against king and rook. So there's an amazing amount of concentration and study and detail, which I was used to as a chess player. And it sort of struck me as amazing that backgammon didn't have that kind of concentrated study. It was all just sort of nebulous stuff, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and three pages on back games and a little bit about holding games, that sort of thing. So I had always been fascinated by the kind of position that arises when one side is playing a back game and hits the other side. Now, the side that's playing the back game, the side that's got hit usually has lots of checkers off. So even once that side's been hit, it's pretty hard to beat them because they have so many checkers off. You have to trap that the checker that you've hit and then eventually attack it and attack it until you close it out and then win from there. But the process of containing that checker is a very complex and difficult one, one of the most difficult parts of backgammon. And so what I wanted to do in this book, which I've been interested in these kinds of positions, is to concentrate on those, on positions where you're down to your last checker or two. And, you know, if your opponent bears all his checkers off before you bear one off, he wins double game. But if he bears them all off while you're still in his home board, he wins a triple game. So when you're waiting to hit a shot, if you wait too long, you can get tripled, which is a big penalty. So these positions with the ace point game is a type of proto back game. It's not a real back game because you only have one point in your opponent's board, and for a game to be a true back game, you have to have 2 points in the opponent's board. But a lot of times you start off with your opponent's ace point, and let's say they just attack you and everything goes wrong in your game, and you end up with just the ace point. Well, you're in a pretty bad situation, but you still can win, but it's not easy. And what I saw with amusement is that in the Mayfair Club, for example, where, as I said, we have these nasty pros and these sort of hapless amateurs who they're playing, that when, you know, the amateurs were always looking on the bright side of things because they just enjoyed playing backgammon and they sort of knew they were going to lose, but they were sort of happy to be in action. The guy who had the ace point game, if he was an amateur, would say, well, at least I'm in the game until the end, which the pros thought was a really idiotic thing to say, and they would mock the amateur by the way they'd say it. Like when they got into that situation, they'd say, yeah, at least I'm in the game until the end. And they'd say it in this sarcastic way, meaning that I'm not a fool like the amateur was, who thinks that this is a great position. So these positions are very emotional too, because there are big swings that occur right at this end. You're sort of like, it's like Custer's last stand, and you're either going to do or die right at the last moment. And in the introduction to the book, I explained that if you don't know the right answer in these situations, you're going to have to rely on your reptilian brain. You're going to either have a flight or fight response instead of being able to, calculate in any kind of calm way what to do. So,
all right. So, Bob, before we continue with the ace point game, we're going to need to take a brief break for commercials, and then we're going to come back to the ace point game, including the Coup Classique, which is the most special ace point game from the defensive side.
Correct.
And we'll see what makes that one so different. So we'll be right back.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In July is the $600,000 Mad Money promotion. All month long, there will be two casino-wide progressives going on, The major one must hit between $10,000 and $25,000. And anyone playing when it goes off who doesn't get the main award receives $25 in free play. The smaller progressive runs between $1,000 and $2,500. It is geared to hit approximately three times per day. On both progressives, you're eligible if you have your card inserted and have bet at least $1 in the minute prior to the jackpot being hit, any machine, any time. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the game. The game of the week is Spin Poker Deluxe. It plays the same as Spin Poker, which has 9 lines active, except that Spin Poker Deluxe has 20 lines active, making it a 100 coins per line game rather than 45 coins per line. The EV and the strategy of the game is exactly the same as in the single line version.
All right, so we're talking about Bucktel, about his book on Ace Point Game. He mentioned it was written 25 years ago. The version I saw was probably 18 years ago, 2001, 2002, something like that. So maybe that was the update to version 1. But the Coup Classique, what is it and what makes it so special?
Well, the Coup Classique is a position where the opponent who's bearing off has taken 12 checkers off already. Now, you only have 15 checkers in a backgammon game for each side. And not only has he taken 12 checkers off, but it's his role as well. And with three men on the deuce point, which is where his checkers are, and you're one checker waiting on his ace point, he's going to for sure take off at least one more checker, and probably two. So you're going to be down to a point where it's your 15 against his two or one. But you still have a pretty good chance to win, and it's a very spectacular kind of coup. You know, a coup is a turnaround of some kind, or it's actually in French it means a strike, like a, you know, getting whacked. So the Coup Classique is the classic turnaround game. And backgammon has, even much more than poker, has the ability to create bad beats and really far-fetched kind of scenarios where a side that's a huge underdog, or at least a side that looks like it's a huge underdog, can pull the chestnuts out of the fire and win. So what happens in the Coup Classique is that when the side that's bearing off has three checkers on the deuce, not four, but three, and the side that's trying to wait for a shot has that one, just a blot, not two checkers, but one checker on the opponent's ace point. Now, if the side bearing off rolls an ace other than a double ace, so that's a 6-1, 5-1, 4-1, 3-1, or 2-1, he takes a checker off with the big number, leaving him two checkers on the deuce point, but then with the ace, he's forced to hit on his own ace point the checker that's been waiting all this time through the whole game, basically, for an opportunity like this. And the ace produces two blots, one on the ace point and one on the deuce point. And now the checker that's been waiting is on the bar, so it comes in. And it will hit with any deuce or ace. That's 20 numbers out of 36. So you're actually a favorite to hit one of these checkers. And now if you have a good enough trap on the other side of the board, which is what you're supposed to have been creating all through the game when you're playing a back game or an ace point game, you can't do anything else except create a trap on your side of the board we call it a prime in backgammon if it's six checkers in a 6 points in a row to contain a checker that you've hit. So if you've got that and you hit one of these checkers, you still have to hit the second checker to have good winning chances. But if you can hit the first checker, hit the second checker, and then attack those checkers so that you can close them out, you become the favorite, even though your opponent has 13 checkers off and you still have your 15. So that's a very spectacular and very well-known position. And like many of the positions in this book, it was known, but it wasn't really researched very deeply, so that how big a favorite or an underdog the sides are in at various points along the way was not really known very well. I should mention that my tools at the time in 1991 when I did the research for this book and wrote it, were pretty primitive. There were no computers that played decent backgammon yet. And so the only way to really understand what's going on in these kinds of positions is to do simulations, which we call propositions in back, or rollouts rather, in backgammon at the time. So it was a lot of sort of lonely work where you would look at the coup classique, you'd look at the position where you'd hit one checker, and then you'd have to work out how big a favorite you were, or an underdog still maybe at that point. But at different points, you'd have to play the position out many, 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 many times. And that wasn't easy either, because the checker play issues were very difficult. So I worked out the coup classique and some other positions and the closeout positions that result from them. And the rest of the book is actual arithmetical computations where I just worked out all the, these are pretty simple positions except for the complicated part of figuring out what happens once a checker's been hit. So the book consists of a bunch of those kinds of that kind of research combined with actual arithmetical calculations to decide in the end whether you're supposed to stay or go in various scenarios.
Hey, Bob, we're running out of time. We do hope to have you back, because we've got lots more questions. But should somebody wish to purchase this book, where is it available?
Well, it's available at the Gammon Press. I guess it's gammonpress.com. And
Bill Roberti and Kent Goulding?
Right. I don't think Kent Goulding is part of the Gammon Press anymore.
Okay. So Bill Roberti, he's been a guest on our show. Yeah.
And it's also sold on Amazon, although, like my second book, which we'll talk about again sometime, it's sort of hard to find because search engine optimization requires backgammon in the title if you're going to be able to find anything when you do a search. So even on Amazon, it's hard to find, but it's there. And it's In the Game Until the End, Winning an Ace Point End Games by me.
So Wachtel is W-A-C-H-T-E-L.
Right.
If somebody wished to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
They could email me. I don't have a website yet, but I'm working on that.
Very good. Did you wish to share your email today or?
Sure. It's bbwach@gmail.com.
Very good. Been a long time since I played backgammon. This is a nice trip for me down backgammon memory lane. I enjoyed it. I hope our listeners have as well. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you, Richard. And go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.